today we've got some really exciting guests. We've got Gerald Clark and his lovely wife, Krista Clark. They're both authors. Gerald Clark is he's an engineer. That's his background. And so he knows a whole lot about technology. And he is an author about the Anunnaki and about Nibiru. He's written two books. And his books are The Anunnaki of Nibiru and The Seventh Planet Mercury Rising. And he's going to tell us a little bit about how he got into this. And his wife, Krista, is a vegan, and she's a vegan blogger and very passionate about recipe creation, yoga, structural integration, alchemy, writing, researching, and shares a passion with Gerald about all things to do with, I guess, mankind's origins and technology. So thank you very much for coming to our show.
Welcome to the show.
It's really great to be here. I want to wish a warm welcome to you and all your listeners.
Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, absolutely. Lovely. Thanks for being on the show. Very excited. Very excited to hear all about Planet X, the Anunnaki, and we're going to have a little major discussion about twin flames and the masculine and feminine energy and how it plays into all of this. So this is, Universal Soul Love. We certainly cover a wide range of topics, metaphysical and spiritual and personal growth topics. And so this is going to be a really exciting show. We haven't done a lot with twin flames and especially in relation to Planet X. So this is going to be really interesting.
Yes, I'm waiting to hear about it. So Gerald, maybe you'd like to take the lead and tell us, plunge us straight into the Anunnaki and Nibiru and all things around that.
Okay, that's a broad introduction, but I'll try to focus it so that we end up where we're trying to get to. For those who don't know, a Precy version of the Anunnaki story is in the Sumerian tablets that were found in the regions in southern Iraq, actually all the way up to areas near Nineveh, all the way to the south, where we would call the area of Sumer in history. We have found several written records, tens of thousands, that have been decoded. This started around the turn of the century. And in that story, which we've always treated as myth, the Sumerians tell us that an ancient race they called the Anunnaki came from their home planet that got caught in a retrograde elliptical orbit with our sun. And they took the opportunity to visit the planet to obtain resources that they wanted to bolster issues that they were having on their planet. So nobody's making the story up. This comes directly from the Sumerians, but it's always been treated like a myth. There were, let me just tell you how I got kind of interested in it. I was reading a book on the way to Turkey, where I was doing business, around 2002. It was called Guns, Germs, and Steel, written by a Pulitzer Prize winner, Jared Diamond. And in that book, he kind of confused my very limited understanding of history by introducing us to the city of Kalahayuk, which was an obsidian trading city there in southern Turkey, that was purportedly 9.5 to 12,000 years old. Well, all of a sudden, I realized I had a real problem as I was researching and studying to do a book on ancient technology and history, that we were told that Sumer rose 3800 BC and that Egypt came afterwards at 3100 BC, and these were the oldest writings and hieroglyphs that we had. Well, all of a sudden, you realize that's not true. Okay, you with me? Okay, so while I was in Turkey, I started to actually develop almost a artificial interest in history because I was dealing with customers there that seemed to be surrounded by history that contradicted everything I knew about the chronology of the human origin. So that got me started, and I started looking at all the books that were already written on the subject matter. Of course, I came across Eric von Däniken's work and Zechariah Sitchin's work, and I got really drawn into Drunvalo Melchizedek's work on sacred geometry and some of the Flower of Life stuff that came out of Egypt, the symbology that came out of Egypt. So that was kind of my genesis back in 2002. And I guess after 2 years, I had read everything that I needed to read, and I was excited to actually share my unique version of it when I started writing my first book in 2004. And I was still very much what I would say in a correlation mode of research, because the theory that our origins were connected with these beings that the Sumerians reported was kind of astounding. It was completely contrary to everything we've been taught. So I felt like I needed some time to correlate this before I ever exposed myself as an engineer. Because you go talking about aliens and stuff at that time, you know, you probably would be out of a job. Okay, so
So in
2004, I started writing this on and off, correlating, corroborating. And by 2013, I finally released the book. So it took me a long time to have mostly the courage to expose what one of my research hobbies was finding out mankind's true origins. So with that said, for those who don't know, there were three seminal documents that I referenced. One is called the Atrahasis. The second is called the Enuma Elish. And the third one, which is more of a epic tale, but it's very famous, is called the Epic of Gilgamesh. And through those three references, one could actually come up with the basics of the story of who the characters were, what happened, who did what to who, and how we ended up in the situation we're in. Just those three documents. And so I really focused on those in my first book, since they had been decoded by the University of Oxford, and there wasn't any issue with concerns about accuracy of translation and so on and so forth, because there's a lot of interest in this topic, but there's also a lot of disinformation.
So Gerald, can I just clarify, because I had read about Zechariah Sitchin that he had actually translated Sumerian, and you know, there is contention about whether he translated correctly or not. So how did you get the translation? Which translation did you use?
Well, like I said, I read all of his works, and he gave you extensive references. And contrary to what people have said, he was a linguist. He shows you in his books all the derivations in infinite detail. And his books are actually very, very academic. And so for the most part, when somebody's bashing what he's written, they haven't even read it. They're repeating what they've heard from other sites. So with that said, a cuneiform digitization process came about because there were tens of thousands of tablets lying around, and they started digitizing them. And we have a uniform script code that you can download on your computer with all the fonts for Sumerian cuneiform. And I have it, and I have it printed out. I can actually read it. Anybody can. It just takes time. You know, match this symbol to the one that's in the hexadecimal code for the uniform code script. And that translates into a word, and we have dictionaries for it now. So it's all electronic now. You don't really have to worry about an individual's accuracy. It's all done, you know, electronically. And actually, most people are in agreement that the translation is, there is no issue anymore.
Right. That's amazing. And so all that information is already there for people that care to be open enough to read it.
And of course... I know you
and
have.
And of course, the idea that mankind had different origins to what we thought is quite a lot, isn't it? It's really a in your face sort of knowledge.
It is, and I could give a very, very quick summary. I've done this 100 times, and get you to the point where we understand the story of how it is we came about, and then we can take it from there if you like. But I know we want to try to head toward some other topics, so I won't spend a lot of time on it. But according to the records, and I have a genealogy table that somebody could follow all of these names, and there's a lot of names, okay? According to the history, they came to this planet 450,000 years ago because they had a problem with bolstering their atmosphere. They came into close perihelion with the sun. They used a transition metal. It seems to be it was gold. So they had continuous issues, and every time they came around the sun, every 3,600 years, their atmosphere would get accosted by either other planets, meteors, asteroids, interaction with the magnetic field of the sun, and so on and so forth. So this is a continuous problem that they had, and this is described in the Enuma Elish, their Babylonian epic of creation, which I put in both of my books, by the way. Very important story about how our solar system came to be in, and how they got caught in it, okay? So here they are, caught in our solar system and having to bolster their atmosphere. Well, at this point, they've probably done a spectroscopic study of every planet in our solar system. They're highly advanced, clearly a lot farther along in the evolutionary process than we are. And they identified the Earth as a place where they could come and get the resources that they wanted. And there's a good reason for that. In the Enuma Elish, there was a collision with one of their satellites of their planet Nibiru with a planet called Tiamat that used to be where the Earth is. Okay, so Tiamat was the original planet. It was broke apart, which became our Earth and Kingu, our moon, according to them. Okay, so they had history in their documents about the Earth anyway. It wasn't just a random, hey, there's some gold over there. And also they described possibly seeds of life from their planet being transferred in an unintentional panspermia on this planet. Okay, so they came here 450,000 years ago to get resources to help their planet, particularly gold. It looked like it was monatomic gold that they wanted to get from the Persian Gulf, where Enki, their scientist, was sent. He was the firstborn son of Anu, their king on Nibiru. So Enki lands in the Persian Gulf, right near where the Tigris and the Euphrates, and emptied it through the Sea of Reeds. And he built the first city on this planet, according to him, which was called Eridu. You can still see this from Google Earth today, and it still just kind of looks like it's been unexcavated, even though there are diagrams of multiple layers of temples upon temples, how ancient cultures build upon them. But we were told that it was 3800 BC when it was built. But according to this record, it was 450,000 years ago. He called it Earth Station 1. And then they built several other pre-diluvial cities that were in Iraq that had various functions, including Nippur, which they called their mission control center. Sippar was the landing site. Bad Tabira was their ore processing site, and on and on and on. So the functional names they gave to these cities and their roles coincided with the mission that he said that they were doing in the Atrahasis tablets. 5,000 years later, apparently the attempt to get gold didn't go quick enough. They vectored off to Africa, where they were mining the gold, didn't really have the proper human workforce to mine versus get it colloidally out of the ocean. And so they kind of had a little bit of a problem. At this point, so it's about 450,000 years, Enki landed there. 5,000 years later, Enlil came. This is his half-brother, who is more of a bureaucratic commander, and Enki is more of a scientist, okay? Well, these two are both the sons of Anu, but one is the half-brother, okay? So this gets deep, and we don't have to go into that right now. So just know they were in Africa pushing their workers to get gold. They've been working for 3,600 years in the first tablet of the Atrahasis, according to them. That's a long time, okay? And that's how they counted years in shars, which was 3,600 years. Well, they revolted. These Ajiji, they called them the Ajiji. They were miners. They did all kinds of manual labor. But they called them fellow gods as well. I don't think they were some reptilian-looking race or anything like that. They actually looked very much like the Anunnaki. They were a subclass of the Anunnaki as well, and highly technical. Once they revolted under the auspices and rebellion calls from none other than Allah, this is right out of the tablet, so you go, who's Allah? Well, here he is showing up, leading a rebellion to get these workers to burn their tools and go get relief. They ended up at the commander's house, Enlil's house, surrounded it with weapons and told him, we're done, we're not doing this anymore. That led to the calling of an Anunnaki council meeting. Not the whole council was there. It was a 12-member council, 6 men, 6 women. They got together, made the decision that they needed a replacement. Enki, the scientist who'd been there 5,000 years earlier, chimes in, says, you know, there's bipedal hominids on the steppes of Africa. Maybe we could modify one of those to be our primitive worker to replace these Ajiji miners. The council agreed, appointed him and his half-sister, the medical officer Ninma, to go down and do exactly that. So in these 11 tablets of the Atrahasis, they tell this story of creating chimeras, genetically modifying, doing this and that, to finally come up with a model that they believed could follow their instructions, their primitive worker, the Adapa, or the Adamu, which in the Bible is our Adam and Eve story.
Wow, isn't that amazing? And that's all written down in the tablets.
Yes, yes. So
that's a very clear and concise synopsis.
So if you just read only one document and read the Atrahasis and treated it as if it might be the truth and not a myth, you'd realize there were some very scientific things going on in there that that we can do now, but we didn't realize they could do it way back then.
Yes,
so
yes.
There have been some genetic studies.
I remember I was reading the works of Michael Tellinger, and you know, and that's where I first came across the fact that man may have been genetically engineered, and that it really shocked me, absolutely shocked me, and brought up all sorts of feelings. But I've since processed that, and
Didn't it take a while for you to process that realization?
It doesn't feel very good that we were genetically engineered to be slaves. I mean, I'm quite sort of astounded and not very happy about that.
Well, when you find that out, though, you start looking at all the genetic problems we have, the fact that we can't survive on this planet like animals do. We're not even developed. We couldn't go out naked and live in the woods and get by the way animals do. We're not designed to do that. We're aliens to this planet if you really look at us from an evolutionary standpoint.
That's interesting.
Lana's certainly, I can't say that I'm very knowledgeable about any of this, but you certainly gave a very, like I said, a very clear and concise synopsis, the best I've heard. Lana's filled me in on a lot of this. Lana's got a lot of knowledge on this as well. But I'm aware of the, you know, we spent some time with Michael Tellinger, but I don't necessarily need to know all of that information. It's nice to know, but I have my own intuitive sense and my own awareness that this is all true, so.
Well, that brings yeah. that,
And it's
that
really brings. Interesting that we have all these myths of the gods, and of course the Anunnaki were giants. They're much bigger than humans, aren't they? And so I believe there's a theory that the gods of Rome and Greece were in fact taken from the Anunnaki, and like big, huge versions of humans.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I published a god table in my first book that basically showed who these beings were, what their names were, in cultures starting from Nibiru in the epic of the Enuma Elish, through Sumer, through Egypt, through Rome. Or through Greece and then to Rome. And then you go, okay, well, where'd they go after that? This is where it gets really, really kind of frightening, is you realize these beings lived a very long time. They had different genetics than we did. They were immortal relative to us, whether they lived, thousands of years or just, 300.
Really?
It didn't matter because we only had a capped lifespan of 120 years. Now, this, by the way, is in the Atrahasis that I wanted to kind of focus in as more of about our constructs of what they did to us genetically, uh-huh. and what they gave us. So it kind of leads into this idea of how you can work with that to get to the highest place you can get in this incarnation. Anyway, we talk about tin flames and so on. So what did they do to us? They first created us using an ovum from some bipedal hominid. We don't know if it was exactly Neanderthal, Cro-Magnon, the Denisovians, or one of many other species that were on the planet, but they finally gave up trying to use animals and use their own DNA to mix with this female zygote. In vitro fertilized one of the members of the council. Her name was Ninma. She was actually the medical officer. We knew her as Isis in Egypt. Okay, it's the same being, and she was Anguille's and Enlil's half sister. Okay, while we're doing AKA names. Enki was known as Poseidon in Greece, and Enlil was known as Zeus. Okay? So you can follow that through to the Roman names, and it's all in my god table in my book. And I actually tried to
can
do all
you,
12. Go ahead.
Jared, could I ask you, who would you say Ares and Aphrodite are?
I believe Aphrodite was another incarnation of Ninma. She had many, many names, but the problem with Isis or Ninma and her nemesis, who was known as Inanna, they were vying for the same symbols and trying to avert, saying, well, I'm the goddess of Venus, you're not, so there's a lot of confusion between a couple of them. And this was not unusual, that there was namesake obscuration, lying about, who was in charge, who was going to be the next zodiacal ruler, and so on and so forth. So getting a god table exactly right, I've never seen one that was perfect, okay? Because they didn't want you to know. That's why they changed their names.
Gerald, it doesn't sound like they're that much more, the technology might have been much better than ours, but sounds like in terms of fighting and in terms of jealousy and other human-like emotions, it sounds like they were just as bad as us.
Right, like
no, actually, I think... I think we're just as bad as them. We got all of our character attributes from them. So serial killers to saints, they had it too. So, you know, I oftentimes say that the religious right will say, well, everything to do with the Anunnaki, they were all fallen angels, right? They're all demons. Yeah. That's the furthest thing from the truth. I mean, that's like calling... now, listen, I want to distinguish something right now. There is a creator of all that they venerated. And I discuss that in infinite detail in my second book. Because everybody goes, well, if the Anunnaki genetically modified this and created us, who created them? You know, so we can understand our pecking order in this evolutionary process. Well,
the hierarchical order of the universe.
Yeah, well, there were ones that were highly benevolent to their creation, and that included the original team that created us, plus a couple others. And there was a very important one that leads into my second book, and this was Enki's son, the Caduceus Bearer, who was known as Thoth in Egypt. He was known as Thoth the Atlantean in the Emerald Tablets. Okay, right. Same being. And he was also known as Hermes in Greece and Mercury in Rome. It's the exact same being. He shows up in the Anunnaki village, by the way, affiliated with the planet Mercury, no coincidence. So. Well, so anyway, so they created us. And then here's where the difficult part started. And this correlates exactly with the Genesis account in the Bible. Noah was the king of the city of Sharupak, and after 600 years, he experienced a flood. Well, if you go read the Atrahasis account, it exactly after 600 years of this primitive breeder working program that they started, they had lots and lots of primitive workers, and Enlil grew tired of their noise and decided he, head of the council on Earth, he was going to get rid of them. So at that point in the tablets, this is where it gets very disturbing and kind of brings you into the idea that the old world order that was happening there might be similar to what this new world order that's arising right now. He introduced Asaku disease and Sarupu disease, cut off the food, cut off the water, and tried to kill all the humans that Enki had created. Okay, and this is in the account, and finally decided to order his brother, the Lord of the Seas, to bring a flood and wipe the rest of them out. Okay, so this ended up with the Noah story that in the Sumerian account was much more detailed and much more telling than the version that we got from the Hebrew account, or even especially from Hollywood. Are you with me?
Yes. I do remember, you know, there was some lost books of the Bible, including the Book of Enoch, which a lot of people know about, and also the Book of the Giants, which came from the fragments. And so there's been many references, and certainly in Greek mythology.
And I believe that I heard from somewhere, I'm not sure whether it was Michael Tellinger or somewhere else that I read, that the information about how Adam and Eve were made was, in fact, written in much greater detail in a much larger, expanded version of the Bible, not just in these Sumerian tablets. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There's a lot of information in the Middle East writings that significantly amplify our very short Genesis crazy version. Now, the Bible, though, does mix a lot of truth with just some sneaky obscurations. You know, in Genesis 1:6, where it talks about, and let us create man in our image and our likeness. Now, you realize that in the Atrahasis account, that's exactly what they said at the end of this council meeting in order to find a replacement for these slaves.
So, no doubt.
Yeah, so it's exactly correlated in my mind. And it turns out it's the same being. Atrahasis was another name for Noah. And there weren't two kings of the city of Sharupak when the flood came. There was only one. And he turns out to be the son of Enki. That's why he saved him. So we don't have to do the whole details about how that happened. But he saved him so that they'd have some primitive work for continue to serve the Anunnaki that stayed.
So now that we know
the
history.
I'm on the gas, you know, God was supposed to make us, and, you know, it makes us feel so special. And in this version, we're made to be slaves. I mean, it's just appalling.
Well, it is, and this is where something very important for me came up, is if this benevolent person who was a geneticist, Enki in particular, and his son Ningxida, who was known as Thoth, if they did this and created us genetically, in my mind, I was looking for, well, what are our limits? How come there are random samples of people with amazing intellectual or telepathy or telepresence capabilities? Is this because the junk DNA that scientists had identified really isn't junk, and in some people it gets activated? That was my theory. Well, if you start looking deep into that now, I just released an article on my Facebook page where some geneticists actually looked at the junk DNA in a human, and they realized this is alien DNA, and it has very specific functions, and we're starting to understand what they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember reading about that, and it just makes so much sense. And as well, you know, the fact that they never found the creature that was in between apes and man, they never found, you know, it appears that mankind just appeared without any sort of predecessors. So all, you know, goes to, support that story. I also have heard of incredible stories about our DNA possibly changing and, getting a third strand of DNA activated. Is that, do you think, related to an Anunnaki DNA, an ascension?
Well, some really interesting research came up in my second book where we were looking at the concept of, well, what did they do to us genetically? They seem to have given us these energetic nerve ganglions that manifest various colors of light. We call them the chakras. And what else did they do? And, Timothy Leary wrote some really amazing information when he was publishing about these latent circuits that he believed humans had that were triggered by symbols, certain timings in your life that would basically represent the milestones you went through in the evolution of your consciousness. And I put those in my second book. I found them infinitely fascinating, especially as related to a latent trigger that could be caused by an energetic change in the earth. You know, so if you're going through your normal rotation around the sun and the entire solar system is drifting in and out of the galactic center every 26,000 or 26,000 years, then, you know, what does that do to our human antenna? What does it do to our energy? And why is there the expectation that we're going to be at the height of our consciousness at a certain time, and then you go back into a barbaristic state where you've lost all your memory? And this seems to be what's happened over time. It's not a linear increase in our knowledge. It seems to go up and down. So that made a lot of sense to me. And then as a part of that, I thought, well, okay, well, if they designed us and this benevolent being used us, according to what he wrote, he used us as primitive workers, enslaved for a time. He viewed it as a jump start, if you can wrap your head around this. We'll let them do this, but we're going to give them the constructs where they can evolve and become just like us. This is where the problem came up between Enki and Enlil. Enlil did not want them evolving. He just wanted a slave force. And Enki realized that in his writings that what he did was wrong. Enslaving anyone was against galactic law. And so he felt like, you know, as he wrestled with fate and destiny for these beings, what it is he could do to make up for that. And that may be why...
I love it, a guilty Anunnaki with a guilty conscience.
Yeah, well, listen, when you realize that, you know, he actually came out and said that, you know, it wasn't right for him to enslave them. But, you know, he was under a lot of pressure to save his planet. And when you get onto another planet, you know, their galactic law may not be as enforceable as it is when you're the only ones there doing what you're doing. And that's not to say there haven't been many other races come to the Earth. I believe there have. And Klaus Dahna, I think, has done really good work in finding some of the evidence of that, as others have, including Lloyd Pye and several others.
Okay, Lana, now that we're in different locations, which makes this somewhat difficult, it's like a panel discussion, but let's just take a music break so that we can fit that in, and then we'll come back. And I think now that we've got all this information, which is excellent background on what we're about to talk about, mm-hmm. with the twin soul aspect of this and how masculine and feminine energies are rising in the world, and how we can we can bring Krista in on this conversation, and we can talk about, I guess, how we can work together to empower ourselves to handle what's happening in the world. Because, of course, we're still in this, and there's still a lot of global issues happening. We talk about it all the time on Universal Soul Love. So let's go to break, and we will come back. Hello, welcome back to Universal Soul Love. This is Detective David Love.
And this is Dr. Lana Love.
Welcome back to our show. Today we have our very special guests, Gerald Clark and Krista Clark. And we're talking about Nibiru, Planet X, and we're about to lead into, we've had a great conversation, and we're about to talk about the twin flame aspect to all of this, the masculine and feminine energies. So welcome back to the show, Gerald. Would you like to just give us your website and contact information and any other information you'd like to share with our audience?
Sure. My website is GeraldClark77.com. It's GeraldClark77.com. And there are links to all my other media pages from there. And Krista, why don't you give yours, because we're about to bust in on your domain here too.
Sure. Mine is vegan.com.
Okay. So I know we had started vectoring toward figuring out what the Anunnaki did to us genetically, how we can work with that. And this is where I got really interested as an engineer. I was looking at these chakras, looking at all this information, going, well, you know, this idea of human energy has been very suppressed by the government, but what is it really, and how could we access it? So I was actually sitting in a lagoon in Hawaii thinking about a paper I had to write for graduation from a structural integration course I was taking. And I was thinking, how would I measure human energy? Would I bring an oscilloscope, all these equipment? How would you truly find out about it? And there's been lots of work done in this space, and I won't go into all that. But basically, the end result is I believe that I found an equation that I published that involves weight and gravity and wavelength and frequency. And that's pretty much it. And you can use and those are all measurable parameters in a human. So I thought, well, okay, these wavelength and frequencies, where are we talking about? Just one of them? No, we've got at least seven of them in our chakras. So this led to this equation that I wrote. Okay. Now, knowing that, we've got seven chakras that are using seven different wavelengths that are somehow ending up as a joint energy in at least one human. And that's before we even talk about bringing another human in, you know, in this twin flame discussion. So for that to work and us to be represented energetically that way, you have to deal with one scientific principle we call the superposition principle. So when you take waveforms and you mix them together in a mixer, or they just collide with each other, something happens. Generally what happens, you get the sum and the addition of those two frequencies. And depending on how they're aligned in phase and frequency, you'll get additions or subtractions. So if you had two sinusoidal waves that were 180 degrees out of phase, and you put them together at the same time, and they were the same amplitude, you'd get a flat line, because all the peaks and all the valleys would cancel each other. Are you with me? So this is kind of the basis of scientific basis of what I believe the principle of this masculine feminine energy coming together and how that means, because we're designed differently. Okay. And,
Gerald, I'm just wondering, I remember that sine wave from physics, and I'm just wondering, are you about to say that if two people are twin flames, then they double their energy, but if they're not, they could cancel each other out?
It's possible. It really comes down to, you know, if you were exactly in phase and in frequency with each other, your energy would be doubled. Now, is that always the case? You know, it's somewhere in between. It's not perfect. And it's like tuning in a radio station. The more you pay attention to it, the more refined you can make it. Right? And that's actually, I think, a good venue for Krista to talk about. Because when we met, we were both vegetarian. And our energies were very similar, but they got even closer as we did some of the things that I think she's going to talk about here.
Yeah, we started out vegetarian and then naturally just kind of went towards a veganism path after noticing just the different effects of different foods and how they made us feel and the effects on our energy. And we were trying to bring things, cut out things that brought our energy down, whether it was, a sexual deviancy or energy or alcohol or anything that brought our energy down. And we focused more on things that raised it through yoga, veganism, alchemy, and even structural integration, which Gerald is trained in.
Yeah, that's actually, I mentioned this equation that I came up with that involved weight and gravity. Well, gravity is one of the most powerful forces that we as humans encounter on this planet, and we don't really pay attention to it. But gravity always wins in this struggle between being vertical and ending up with a kyphotic hump or a deviated spine, right? It always wins. So when I was looking at the human structure and reading about some of the descriptions from Thoth, he basically agreed with me that essentially a human is an antenna. And gravity is one of the frequencies that we have to integrate. So how do you do that? Well, I got into structural integration mostly for my my son's health issues because of his structure. But it turns out that if you can align an antenna in a frequency field and have it the right, you know, dipole and all that, you can actually pick up the signal. Well, that's no different than a human. So if your antenna is in good shape, meaning you attempt to align it in the gravity field, that equation I wrote has a lot more significance because gravity controls the equation.
My goodness. So how does one align one's antenna?
Well,
is it with yoga and with diet?
Well, actually, there are trained people that know how to look at the lines and planes in the human body and relate them to various planes, and this is what the whole structural integration field is about. Some people call it Rolfing. The inventor of the work was called Ida Rolf. Her name was Ida Rolf, and it has been around since about the 60s, okay? But it's a very powerful work. If you pay attention to the lines and planes of the body, here's a real simple one, for instance. Just look at anybody that's standing or walking and see if their ear opening is directly over their shoulder. If it is, then their bowling ball size head that weighs a lot is balanced on top of their torso. Okay, but generally that is not the case. Without structural integration and intervention into a being's natural progression with the gravity field, gravity always wins. And it usually does it so early in our lives that by the time we're 7, 8 years old, we can't sit up straight. We can't stand up straight because there are connective tissues in your body that have adapted to the forces of gravity that you can't overcome and you're not even aware of them. So from that standpoint, structural integration was a very powerful mechanism for increasing your human energy.
Wow.
So the old saying that you have to walk tall and as if there's something that is pulling you up, that's actually very good for you.
Get better reception.
Yeah, it's exactly. Think about it as an antenna. And you know that in the tailbone or the coccyx bone, there's a nerve ganglia that is affiliated with the kundalini energy awakening. It's represented as a coiled snake. Well, that's like a spring that has potential energy that is released, right? And this is in the yogic tradition. They describe this. Well, you know, in the process of doing yoga or structural integration or other things, you can change the relationship of your cartilage and your connective tissue to your antenna. So the bottom line is, if you can figure out how to soften up your connective tissue, your antenna will naturally align to the gravity field if you're just simply playing the game of trying to keep your bowling ball on top of your torso. Truly, there's an intelligence inside all of us that knows how to find that radio station and tune it in. Mm. But you just got to trigger it.
And so how does all this work?
Can I ask how that relates to our other bodies? Aren't we supposed to have ethereal bodies and our spirit bodies? And, if your human body is nice and straight, does that mean our other bodies are functioning better? Or?
Well, from my understanding is that we are predicated by an energy template that works with your DNA that then grows your biological material to try to match that. So there's an energy body understanding of what you look like, and then there's the physical body that tries to fit into this environment and adapt to that. Well, those two are often very disjoint. And what I found, and I've had hundreds and hundreds of clients as a practitioner of structural integration, when you soften up the body for it to find the gravity field, those two start merging into one. That doesn't mean that the energy that is animating you is, let's just say this, the energy that's animating you is eternal. You are already, your essence is immortal, all of it. That's true for all of us. There's nothing you have to do to work for that. You don't have to go pay a dowry to any church to get that. It's endemic in you, okay? And so understanding how to optimize that realization of mixing your physical form with your energetic template, and when those two do meet, It's very, very powerful, a very powerful experience that I believe has a lot to do with hemisync and lots of other actually physical changes that happen, even at the DNA level in a human. So we talked about those latent circuits. So as this energy goes up and from your lower chakra up to the top, it changes some of the glands in your system as well to make them more functional, including the pineal gland that we now know with Dr. Rick Strassman's wonderful work that produces dimethyltryptamine, which is seen as a spirit molecule that connects you to other dimensions, right? Other frequencies.
We do know about that, yes.
Yeah, so that I wrote about that in my first book because I had that experience.
Right. Sure. We're going to be talking to Dr. Rick Strassman shortly. We have an interview coming up.
He's the authority. I defer to him. He's the absolute authority on this.
For sure. Yeah. So
how does one go about having structural integration?
Well, I oftentimes get this, and I wrote it in my book, but if you go to Rolf Guild, ROLFGUILD.org, you can find a practitioner in your area. It's not very expensive. It's the best money you'll ever spend in your life on your body, trust me. And, you know, I know you guys are in Sydney, but the structural integration community is very strong in Australia.
Okay.
Yeah, so check it out.
Okay.
So I do want to redirect us back to the twin flame topic. Where are we going with this, and how does this relate to what's happening in the world and this Anunnaki enslavement of our species?
Okay. I'll kind of go quick. I know we didn't have that much time here, but Krista laid the groundwork for what we could do to individually improve our own energies to make it synchronous with our partner. Well, this turns out to be a very profound teaching by Thoth, where he talks about the two energies, masculine and feminine, that he had complete control over. As a matter of fact, he was considered a hermaphrodite because he, in his incarnation as Thoth, he took on, and Hermes, he took on both the male and female energies into his body. And the female energy he describes is none other than Enki's half-sister Isis and his own. So whenever you see those masculine, feminine symbols, those come from him. He's the gatekeeper for all of them. But as individuals, we're split off into the masculine and the feminine energy. But when we come in together and find this mystery of what we're describing, there's a lot more available to somebody who's experiencing that than somebody that's not. And you guys are twin flames, like you said. You know what I'm talking about.
Well, I do, because Thoth certainly the... almost the god of the mystics, I suppose. I call myself a mystic. I have a mystical past life lineage. And certainly Lana and I are very powerful as a couple, and we've accomplished a great deal in a short time. And some amazing things have happened since we've been together. And much of it I can't even explain, like much of my life. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. It's very true.
I mean, certainly that's a combination of energies that's you know, almost like a sine wave that's doubled. That's certainly something we very much feel. It's almost like becoming more of yourself. You know, David and I have very similar interests, and we're able to then pursue it because, you know, you've got double the power. And, of course, we also are very interested in Tantra. Tantra, of course, being the lifestyle almost of how the masculine and the feminine can come together in almost a sacred sexuality and a sacred attitude towards each other, and the ability to enhance each other's kundalini force.
So
is that something that you address in your book, or that you and...
We experienced exactly the same thing. You know, it's the respect for each other's energy. If you're not judging each other and operating out of love, naturally the synchronicity between two beings can arise. So it brings up the question, can we all couples be twin flames?
Great question.
That's why I think Krista's book is so important. If you make the decision that you want to be a twin flame and you didn't feel like you were when you met, and I'm sure there are lots of people like that, this is a pathway that you can take to end up in the same room of the house with each other, and it makes it much more fun, a lot more fun.
Lana and I were actually written into Arielle Ford's new book, How to Turn Your Mate into Your Soulmate. And
there you go.
Happily Ever After. It's interesting, and I had never thought of it that way, and so, you know, that's exactly what you're saying.
Well, mine's more of a scientific and pragmatic approach, okay, including Krista's, but... But I believe there's a real basis for this, and it really comes down to this concept of energy and the superposition principle. And this, by the way, is measurable. As a scientist, I've looked at resonant field imaging and polychromatic interference photography and Curlian. The idea that we have ethereal layered energy forms in the human existence is true, and this is discussed in the Emerald Tablets, very detailed by Thoth as well, where he lays out the construct of how we were made.
Emerald Tablets. Could you just clarify where they came from?
Well, according to Thoth, he was an Atlantean. He wrote these, according to him, 50,000 years ago when he left Atlantis under his father's rulership as Poseidon, Enki, the same being, father and son. He left to go to Egypt, where he took and recorded this knowledge for the Egyptian priests and hid them in his temple there. Well, about 1925, for some reason, somebody was given authorization to go and get these, decode them, and then put them back. And this gentleman's name was Doriel. And so he's published the book, and it's also on the internet that you can find this. And I included the Emerald Tablets from Thoth in my second book, and I decoded each one independently for us. So it was kind of a grand undertaking, but because of our constructs and who Ningxida Thoth was, I thought it was very important to tell his side of the story.
Wow. Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. And you know what? What strikes me is how much of our history that we don't know.
Oh, I think the majority of the real history we don't know. And what we've been told has just been given to us to keep us in line. So,
total fabrication, but that's fine.
Exactly. Well, you guys have exhibited some interest in their home planet of the Anunnaki, which they called Nibiru, in the Enuma Elish. The planets were given names of the gods, and they were affiliated with each one. And the Nibiru was changed to the name of Enki's first son, which was Marduk. So you'll see his name in there. He takes ownership of that planet. But so it goes by a lot of different names. In the Bible, they might call it Wormwood or some other names. But so it's the same thing that we're talking about. So, you know, I didn't get real focused in my first book about where is the Nibiru right now. And I kind of looked at some of the historical records and said, well, there were some big floods that happened in the past. Was that it? And I tried to pin it down. And that's probably why I wrote this Nibiru Orbital Report, because everybody was asking that same question last year. So I discussed this with you guys, and everybody wants to know exactly where it is. We could talk a little bit about it on air, but it's kind of a complicated thing. The bottom line is, mathematically, using the information from the IRAS, the infrared satellite that was used by NASA in the 1980s to determine where this was, and they put more than one. There were Pioneer and Voyager probes as well. Are you guys still with me?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so I published this in a Nibiru Orbital Report that I put it on Amazon, blah, 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 and it's on my website. But I'm thinking at this point, because this information is so important, and my window of arrival went from July of last year to the end of this year. And it's, like I said, it's mathematical based on approximations, and nobody can pick the exact date unless you have the instruments to look at it. But because of the earth changes that we're seeing, I mean, they're just astounding, the number of earthquakes and volcanoes that have increased over the last 10 years. It's just unbelievable.
It's all happening.
Yeah, and if you're brave enough to go on YouTube and look up Two Suns or Planet X or Nibiru, you'll see it's just an unbelievable amount of information and pictures and videos coming from amateur astronomers all over the world. So it's become a really, really important topic, so much so that I just did a show yesterday, and that's a lot about what we talked about. And this is you know, on TV, so like, you know, it's coming out. The governments have been trying to hide it. They built all their underground bunkers to go survive it. But this is where it brings up some very important issues about dealing with your own personal spiritual ascension path, or if you're going to be a survivalist and try to go build a bunker and survive this thing. And this is where this is where the two camps are, in my opinion. And in my report, I gave my particular position on that. And, you know, I was an ex-helicopter pilot in the military and blah, blah, blah. And I have a pretty strong survival instinct. But at the same time, because of where I am on this energetic and this ascension path, my focus is on energy and ascension, and the discussion that I had in my second book about how you get out of this holographic entrapment and pick this window of opportunity to ascend to a higher place instead of being recycled as another version of a slave. You know, so that's really, in my opinion, what's going on. So we have a choice, but it takes a lot of courage and knowledge to make the right choice.
Jill, can you clarify what ascension means? Do you mean sort of like dying and going to heaven, or going into a different dimension?
I don't know if I can do this justice quickly, but in the Emerald Tablets, Thoth lays out a model of our understanding of the holographic universe, all the way back from the creator of all, his domain, through the various dimensions, from nine dimensions all the way down to ours, which we consider the third dimension, with nine parallel dimensions and then 14 lower dimensions. So there's all these dimensions that he talks about. And a dimension for an engineer is a frequency. Okay, and I explain that in detail in my second book. So there are these different frequencies of reality where energy can take on a body and have an experience in an event queue that turns into a chronology. Okay, and for them, they can see it all instantaneously from beginning to end. There's no time for them. And I talk about this concept of time because Thoth brings us up in the Emerald Tablets. And I did a really deep dive on the 10th Emerald Tablet because that's what he's talking about. What is time? So once you understand that and realize that how the hologram is set up, my idea is not to stay in the third dimension enslaved where you can't get out. And anybody who's had an out-of-body experience realizes, possibly, if they've gone very far, that we seem to have the ability to go out to the edge of our dimension. And in the Egyptian writings, they talked about accessing the Duat. Well, this is also in the Atlantean writings from Thoth, where he talks about this place that he views as the portal where you can leave the third dimension and go to much higher ones. He even encourages you to go to the sixth dimension to visit beings that are ascended in his writings. So when I talk about ascension, I talk about access to higher dimensions, I guess you would say, and possibly having a different, more freer experience than an enslaved one that I believe this holographic simulator was designed for, was to evolve our human consciousness in a place where we could be galactic neighbors with higher ascended beings.
So tell me, does the ascension involve the death of the body, or does it involve the energy becoming so so fast that the body becomes like a light body and loses its third dimensionality?
Well, I think it has to do with our understanding of how matter is created from light, and this is the hologram, okay? Because we're all created from light when it really comes down to it in physics. So the teachings that Thoth gives you is how to take on more light and rid yourself of darkness in order to reach a place where at a certain point, and this is a discussion in the alchemy circles, that Thoth is the first alchemist, okay? He is the man. He says at a certain point that if you struggle and strive to overcome darkness, that they will recognize that and they will engage you and initiate you into being a son of light and activating the energy in your body that allows you to go through this duat, and they call this the ka. Okay, so I'm sorry, there's the ba and the ka. Okay, the ba is the energy that allows you through the portal. The ka is your energy that you're born into of this illusion of matter. Right, so it goes beyond multiple cultures. The Indian cultures and their religion view this the same way, the illusion of Maya, right? So all matter is transitory and an illusion.
So that's interesting. Certainly on Universal Soul Love, our audience is a mix of spiritual activists with varying degrees, some going into survivalism and some going into just ultra light worker, energy healing and meditation. And so there's always a struggle in ideologies on this and which way to go. And we've had guests from martial masters to just all kinds of interesting guests with lots of great ideas on this. And I like you. So your position is, I'm wondering, do you believe that it's best to just avoid all forms of, I don't know how to put this, conflict with dark forces and just focus on the ascension and anything to do with keeping a positive attitude and just raising your vibration? Is that your thinking on this?
Yeah, I think we're saying the same thing. It's, you know, if you're doing anything out of fear, it's not done out of love. And I believe those are kind of opposed to each other. So if you're operating out of fear of saving your carcass because a planet's going to come by and cause perturbations, I don't see that as the right path. It seems like a pragmatic
Absolutely.
Thing to do, because if a tree is going to fall and you see it's going to hit you, you're going to get out of the way. So, you know, it's kind of the same
sure.
kind of
okay.
same thing. But at the
Fair
same
enough.
Time, I think you can do pragmatic things to keep yourself in the game. And you have to then ask yourself, what in the world am I here for? You're an avatar with a mission, and the mission has to do with this higher goal for all beings. And it's not just us evolving to higher states. It's every being on every other dimension, according to Thoth. Lower dimensions, the parallel dimensions, the higher ones. We're all working toward the same goal, is basically becoming the sun soul being that was a instance from the creator of all. We're all on that same path. Okay? So, in that sense, we're at the end of the race, in a way. There's an ascension window coming open. And instead of going and hiding and trying to perpetuate your transitory form, in my mind, it's probably the best time to not only get yourself up to the highest state, but to share with anyone else that could actually facilitate their path changing and them getting out. I think it's so important that if you do that and facilitate it for someone else, it's almost like an altruistic thing. If you could make a change in someone else's life by sharing over the radio like what you guys are doing, and you're facilitating other people's paths to find the way out, I think that's even more important than finding the way out for yourself. But you generally can't help someone else to a point other than the place that you've already been. So you
sure,
help from
absolutely.
The place. So you got to kind of do both.
And coming from my background, you can understand, you know, being a private detective, I've certainly seen a lot of things, and I come from a place where I at the very least believe in compassionate use of force and protective use of force, and that may not be valid, and I know I'm not always right, and I'm certainly working through a lot of stuff, and I try to use discernment and higher awareness and keeping a heart-centered focus, you know, on my outwardly actions. But it's really difficult to know, you know, because there is a bit of an activist in me, and there is in Lana, and we address that, the social activists and the environmentalists and the animal rights advocates, and I feel that they're very important and that their role is important, and but it's a very difficult path to tread to really know, and I think we're doing a pretty good job, and hopefully, you know, we certainly do focus on, I think the most important thing is the awakening, the great awakening, and like you just said, and informing people and being a positive beacon of light, as some of our other guests have brought up, and I think that's the way, that is, the, you know, the...
And it's actually very good news. It's just, I really appreciate you... I guess telling us this and perhaps recontextualizing the whole process of Nibiru coming closer and the planet having these shifts and the ability for us to awaken so that you know, perhaps the goal is not survival, the goal is perhaps ascension. And it sounds like doing kind deeds and, you know, trying to improve the planet is important as at the same time, in some introspection and some working on oneself is also important. And it's very good news. It's very exciting. It's a bit frightening.
It is.
Well, we're going to see some destruction as the old system is torn down. And whether you're around in this avatar body to experience it or a new one in another dimension, who knows? But, you know, listen, we're all doomed. None of us are going to make it past 120 years, pretty much. That was the clamp they put on us. So, you know, trying to preserve it for a few more years in a underground bunker, I just don't see that as a way that's going to help humanity. Mm. So I'm going to stay on the surface. I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. And if just one person got out of their enslavement of their thinking or their energy body to a higher place, and I had anything to do with it, then it's enough for me.
Mm. Of course, in Universal Soul Love, we talk a lot about the fact that that we are eternal beings, and you know that we're the mortality is just our body. So, and
that's,
you know, it's important
principle.
For people to awaken to that fact.
Mm. We need to come to terms with our physical mortality and our eternal soul, and that was one of the most important spiritual concepts I came to before I came to a lot of other ones, and it was just so freeing to know.
I think you pointed out something really important is when you came to that place, and you said this earlier off air, that you're operating without the fear of what's going to happen to your material form. And that's when you can become powerful, especially
as
a twin flame, both of you supporting each other, because, you know, you're out in a different realm of the hologram when you're dealing with this kind of stuff.
I've often said, once you overcome your fear of death, life becomes much, there's what is there to lose in life? What is there? I mean, your fear in life is lost once your fear of death is overcome.
But, you know, that's you can't be intellectualized, though. You know, people that overcome their fear of death, they have to have an energetic experience where they realize that their energy goes on outside of their material form. And anybody who's played around with out-of-body experience, by the way, Thoth talks about this and gives you a sequence of how to do it in his writings. And
okay.
I included that in my second book. So, and I also included stuff from Robert McRow, who was an expert on journeys out of body.
Oh, that's wonderful. Expert. We're going to be speaking to him next week.
Oh, wow. Well, tell him I said thank you. I was having this experience when I was a kid, and my high school humanities teacher gave me his book to read, and it really answered the question of what was happening to me.
Those were my favorite books. Robert Monroe was one of my heroes, and we had Nancy McGonigal, the executive director of the Monroe Institute, on our show not too long ago. And now, we're having Joseph McGonigal, and we're very excited about that. And I've had my own classic out-of-body experiences, traditional out-of-body experiences, and that was really a life-changing for me. It wasn't a great experience. I saw some dark beings, I guess you could say, some astral wildlife and a number of other astral parasites, but nonetheless, it opened my mind up to the truth that there's more to what we're perceiving in this reality, in this physical reality. There's more to the story, a bigger picture, and that's what was important. That's what led me to just keep pursuing the path of a truth seeker, and it just kept going, and that's the journey. And it was just really, really, really important to me. And we still pursue that, which is why we're so connected to the people at the Monroe Institute and really respect their work.
Wow, that's amazing. Chris and I both want to go there.
Yeah, so do we. Yeah, we're hoping to.
I must say, your book, Gerald, sounds like it's amazing. It sounds like it's packed full of answers to everything I've always wanted to know. Have to get it.
Actually, there's a couple people.
Your website again?
It's Gerald Clark.
Your website again?
It's GeraldClark77.com. I encourage people to go read a couple of the reviews that were done on my Amazon.com for The Seventh Planet. It's a very deep book. You know, it basically answers the question, like I said, from my first book, if the Anunnaki created us, who created the Anunnaki, and what do we do with that? It's very, very deep.
Yeah, that's like philosophy. It's just, it does get that way, the rabbit hole.
Wow.
But I think we've reached the end of our interview, it sounds like.
I think we have. Just before we finish, I can't not ask this question. I've read that there are these sort of giants, the Anunnaki's bodies that have been found in various places in Iraq, and that some of them appear not to have died. Some of them are so well preserved, they're thought to still be alive in some sort of state of suspended animation, and that they might actually be waking up.
Well, it's interesting. I just got... one of my book fans just sent me a link to the bodies that were found in Iran that Russia seems to have control of. And I just posted it on my Facebook page with a link to the original Russian converted to English, so you can read about this with all the videos that they have of these beings. They don't appear to be really, really tall, maybe 8 feet tall. I can't really tell. They're laying horizontal. But one of them does appear to be in some sort of stasis state. The tissue is still malleable. It looks like he's alive, just asleep, and it's astounding. You know, a lot of the internet community says, "Oh, this is a hoax, and it's been tried to be killed." But if you go read this article from the researchers that I just published, directly from Russia, where they were in control of this, it brings up some really amazing questions, and it does appear to be one of them is sporting the symbols of Ahura Mazda Enki himself, because Ahura Mazda, the chief deity of Persia, was Enki. And his son, Zarathustra, Ken Zarathustra, was none other than Ningxida, his son. So it's very possible that they've done this. And in the Emerald Tablets, Thoth talks about having to go into a stasis state for 100 years out of every 1,000 to preserve that particular avatar body. That doesn't mean he couldn't take on other ones, too. Okay, so this is where it gets difficult to wrap your head around how many places they could be at one time.
Oh, that should be exciting. So we might get a few giants waking up, and I wonder what Obama and Putin will think about that. That should be interesting. Look, wonderful to have you both on the show, Gerald Clark and Krista. Of course, with your would you like to give your website?
Sure, it's artisticvegan.com.
Yeah, and I think you got mine. GeraldClark77.
Wonderful.
Okay.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much. I'm going to go out
and
buy your books. That just sound absolutely fascinating. So can't wait for the ascension process.
Well, we're going to keep talking about it, so it's not going away. But I don't know how long our window is open to be able to participate in this. Maybe until the guru comes. Who knows? But we're going to keep working.
Right.
That's all you can do.
All right. Goodbye from Universal Solar. And do tune in next week.
Yep. Thank you very much, and we will see you next time on Universal Soul Love.